Hi, my name is Clayton Platt, and I'm the host of Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. And it's my honor today to have as our guest Nick Hamburger. And I met Nick a number of years ago at the tail end of a silent retreat when the noble silence was lifted and we had an opportunity to talk. And I saw this young man. And I thought, oh, man, this must be his first retreat. Love to find out what his experience was when I introduced myself and we talked, I found out that his experience with retreats was much broader than mine, which is, when we get to know him, not a surprise. So Nick, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Clayton. Excited to chat.
So Nick, one of the things that I recall when we talked earlier was that you were in high school, a competitive, high-level competitive tennis player. And you had a competitive streak, which I can actually identify with, and it had some ramifications, which unfortunately I can also identify with, which was you had a tendency to occasionally break a racket, and perhaps more rackets than you or your family were pleased about. And you were telling me about the reaction that your mother had around breaking the racket and an introduction to a technique to potentially deal with that. Would you mind sharing that story with us?
Yeah. So this was my introduction to meditation. It came through being a competitive tennis player growing up and having a lot of anger that showed up on the court. And all throughout, my childhood, kind of from age maybe like 8 or so up until into high school. And I broke 7 rackets in like middle school and high school. I think it was something my mom and I discussed a lot, and we'd try to work on my mental game. And in my senior year of high school, I had a knee injury and got surgery. And so then I had a number of weeks like just on the couch, you know, even before I could like walk really. And she was like, this is the perfect time to work on your mental game because you really can't move and can't do anything. And so she gave me a Joseph Goldstein meditation tape, Mindfulness of Thinking. And right there in that first meditation, like there was this exploration of what are thoughts, and kind of I had the experience of being able to observe my internal voice, which up to that point I just thought was like right, or it was like, you know, the authority on life. And I didn't know that you could just listen to it like music or like someone else talking. So right away I got very into it, and I think it did help with my temperament on the court, although I never got back to competing quite in the same way, because that was end of high school, beginning of college, but definitely catapulted, my interest in meditation, which became and kind of still is my biggest passion, I would say.
Yeah, that introduction to how to deal with mind chatter. We had a previous guest on the podcast, Dr. Mitchell Green, who wrote a book on that. And so having you sort of demonstrate that, yeah, this was a way to deal with it, even though it didn't end up playing a major part in your tennis career, which I guess from a competitive standpoint ended there. But you have had an amazing career so far in your short life. And I'd love for you to kind of talk through, you know, you went to college and things changed when you got to college, right? The normal route of just going to classes and working towards a major and graduating and getting a job, that wasn't exactly your path. And again, I want to talk about this and then also circle back to how your burgeoning mindfulness practice kind of played into some of this and your lessons along the way. So what happened when you got to college?
Yeah. Getting to college, I think immediately I was wrapped up in the question of what I wanted to do probably faster than I needed to be. Like I remember beginning a freshman year already kind of getting obsessed with that question. And I guess one of the first things that helped was I quit the tennis team pretty like, I guess midway through my freshman year, but that freed up a lot of time for other explorations. I did a couple of retreats, the summer after my freshman year, which were my first retreats. And those were really encouraging and inspiring and filled me with a lot of energy. And in my sophomore year, my best friend Zach and I ended up starting a business through this business competition at University of Chicago. And we won that competition and won some funding and ended up running with it. And I dropped out of school after sophomore year. So, but I had felt at the beginning of sophomore year, that sense of like, I really want to be doing something in the world. I'm a little bit restless in class. And as you said, that traditional path of just like finishing 4 years and go into some one industry or another, like I was definitely wanting something a little bit less well-trodden than that.
So you are very humble about sort of that experience because I think for most of us, we would look at that and say, there's some mind-blowing elements to this. So you and your friend Zach entered a competition, a business competition at University of Chicago. And tell me a little bit about the what you put together with Zach. What was it that won the competition? And then you know, what exactly did you do with it after that?
Yeah. Zach is a type 1 diabetic. And so growing up, he would cook eggs a lot as a low-carb snack, kind of more convenient. And he was doing insulin injections every time he had carbs. So eggs were a nice kind of no-carb option to avoid having to account for carbs with insulin. And he loved the crispy like edges of an omelet, the little pieces of egg that are left in the pan when you cook eggs. And so he had always had this idea of like, it's probably possible to make a chip, a snack out of eggs. And we had some early prototypes. And so we're like, let's enter this business challenge at UChicago. And throughout the process of being in that course, in that competition, the product got a lot better. And yeah, we ended up with this high protein, low carb chip made from egg whites. And things just kind of gathered momentum throughout that course and afterwards. And it really, we didn't think that it would end up kind of consuming our lives in the way it did, but it really took on a life of its own.
So in fairness, so that experience with what happened at University of Chicago, excuse me, hopefully we can edit that, University of Chicago. sort of you have a business now, and if I'm not mistaken, you also went on Shark Tank?
Yeah, we did. I ended up running the business for 5 years. And I was dropped out of school for even longer than that. We went on Shark Tank our episode came out January of 2021, which was about 3 years into the business. And that was a very crazy experience and really helpful for the business and for our sales and everything. And and also something we could talk about, the experience of actually filming, which I don't know how much I was able to use mindfulness, but it was certainly a very emotionally overwhelming experience.
Well, let's talk about that right now, because again, our theme here is mindfulness in real time, and it doesn't always show up as, oh, I'm able to completely deal with this because I'm sitting on a cushion and right. So your ability to identify, as you've started to do, all the emotions that were arising, what were they? And then perhaps what did you learn from that experience that you could use later?
The first thing was, the morning before going on the show, a lot of nerves, a lot of energy in the body. And then as we were we're basically at a certain point, they told us, okay, we're pretty much ready for you. So we waited outside these doors that open up to the hallway where you walk down. And when we were waiting for those doors to open, it felt like a race. Like I ran cross country in middle school. And so it felt like that feeling of like the gun's about to go off to start. And you're just like, you got so much adrenaline. I've had other experiences like this since where when there's so much energy in the body, it can kind of get to a point where I think I just haven't necessarily trained enough to handle it. So my response is to dissociate, not on purpose, but it just happens. And so by the time we were actually up there in front of them and starting to talk, I kind of felt that feeling of just being a little bit distant from the whole experience, which was probably helpful because then everything we'd practiced just kind of came rolling out, and we had a lot of good answers to their questions. And but yeah, I didn't feel loose. Like I felt definitely very tight. And like if they would have asked me to go too far off script, I think it would have been bad. If they would have just said, you know, hey, what did you eat for lunch yesterday? I would have been like, well, I didn't practice that, you know.
So that you're able to stay on the flow because they kind of kept on a track that you were comfortable with. And yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it would have been, I don't know, like definitely if I was doing more media stuff at some point, I think I would hope to be able to remain in my body a little bit more in front of the camera. But, you know, given that this was our first kind of like big thing like that, you know, I think it was fine to dissociate. But yeah, it was kind of a very surreal experience.
The results were fine, though, right?
Yeah, and it worked out well, which was nice. And then afterwards, you feel this real crash. Like, and they actually have you talk to a psychologist after you film, because I think all of reality TV has this standard where anyone who goes on needs to talk to a psychologist afterwards, especially for the negative experiences where people feel attacked by the sharks, or, you know, if you're on a dating show and you could bring up all these emotions. So we talked to the psychologist and they just said, you know, even though you feel okay now, you might notice a lull post all of this adrenaline. And I feel like we did, you know, the next couple, the rest of that day was very fun, but the next 2-3 days I felt very sapped. And yeah, he said, just watch your mind and watch your, like, make sure you're talking to people and still living your life, because with that lull, sometimes people can sink into like a little bit of a depression, he said. So that was an interesting aspect of it too.
That's fascinating. I had no idea, never having been on reality TV or TV at all. it makes some sense. And I want to go back to that period when you're in college. All right. And now you and Zach have sort of started the company, and at some point, you're doing both, right? You're running the college, you're running the business and you're doing your studies. You made the decision to drop out. Would you say, again, because you already were in a position where you're doing a fair amount of meditating, would you say that there was a mindfulness element that played into the decision to say, this is where I need to be, this is where my energy seems to be flowing?
Well, definitely the decision felt that way. Like I don't know. I probably would have made a similar decision with or without mindfulness. But like, cause it was just so obvious that, all my energy and all my enthusiasm was starting to go towards the business. You know, I did have, like, looking back, I think a bit of a naive dream that I'd been on these retreats, you know, the summer prior, and I'd felt it was very impactful. And I think I had that early meditation experience of just wanting to spread it and everyone should meditate. And so I had a naive dream of like, well, if I can make a lot of money with the business, then I can use that to open meditation centers and fund meditation research. So there was some like, I think there were delusions of grandeur in there as well, which I guess through the years I've become mindful of that. At the time, I think I was 19, so I didn't have a context for that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I would have to say, looking back at myself as a 19-year-old and 19-year-olds that I've known, having been a parent, et cetera, I'm not sure I know a lot of 19-year-olds who would have had that particular vision of grandeur, which says, I would like to help the world become meditators. So to me, nothing wrong with that thought at the time, but I completely get the fact that it's like, perhaps that isn't realistic, you know, especially for someone at that age. And who knows, maybe later in life it will be. But that moment of like putting together your personal experience, which is, I'm getting a lot out of these retreats, and it's something that I think everybody would benefit from. And here I have a business which can make a lot of money. So I think there's a lot to be learned for all of us in that scenario, which is A plus B does not necessarily lead us to C. It can lead us in many other different directions, and staying open to that. And it sounds like, again, you were over time open to like, okay, maybe we're going to put that as a backtrack, or maybe that it never happens, but it was a nice thought at the time.
Yeah. Well, and I definitely feel like, if there's one thing I'm proud of myself for doing, I think it is always following that current in my life. And now it's landed me back at school. I'm finishing my degree after 6.5 years off. But, after running the business, I was able to do a bunch of meditation retreats, including a 3-month retreat at IMS, which was like my big dream for a long time. So, I'm happy I did that, and I think now it's like, this is probably the least sexy part of my journey so far, is like returning back to school, but it's appropriate for what I'm hoping to do next. So it's, there's been a very meandering current.
So let's go to that 3-month retreat. That's way longer than I've ever been on a retreat. And I think most people who listen to this podcast, many of them will never have been on a retreat. So the thought of being silent for 3 months is mind-boggling. But what would you say, as you look back at that, what sort of things flowed from that for you? Things that you might have taken from that experience that were unexpected, learning moments, and just, in fact, what was it like being on a 3-month retreat?
Yeah. Well, it was definitely, I think looking back, it would have been nice to build up a little more steadily. Like I had done a couple of week-long retreats, a couple of 10-day retreats. And IMS says, as long as you've done 2 or more retreats of a week or longer, you're like eligible. But looking back, I think it would have been great to do a month-long retreat before the 3-month to like test the waters of that. And because it was very intense. the first few weeks, I think there was a lot of resistance. My body and mind, I think, had a sense of like, if we actually are dedicated to the practice for, 10, 12 weeks, like it's going to change us a lot. And so I think there's that resistance of like, I don't necessarily know if I want to change. And kind of like the come up on a psychedelic experience of like, did I really sign up for this? Do I really want to do this? After like 2 or 3 weeks, settled in a little bit more. My experience, I think everyone's experience is totally different. I had a number of questions, burning questions in my head about certain things about psychology, certain questions I had about the teachings that I was really hoping to get answered. And so I was doing a lot of the meditation sessions, but also outside of the sessions, I had certain, questions I was thinking through. And those ended up all getting answered like automatically by the silence. Like that was probably the coolest experience in the retreat, were maybe 5 to 10 different moments in meditation where the mind is pretty quiet, because it's day 40. And I didn't even ask a question, but it was something that I'd wondered about in my life, or I'd wondered about a week ago or something, or I journaled about it. And it would just, an answer would bubble up from beneath or from above. I don't know where it's coming from. So I'd never really had that experience. I mean, in that intensive way, I think I'd had it before. Maybe you have a question and suddenly you realize the insight, but this felt very much like like people talk about getting a download. So that was really cool. Also though, a lot of the insights I was getting, I still had this kind of paradigm of grandeur of like, well, I need to write a book. I need to share all these things, which I think a lot of people and a lot of young people experience in the spiritual world. So that was still there. And there was a lot of anxiety around that. I'm like, how do I put this all together and share it with the whole world, as if everyone's going to want to read that book. There, a lot of people aren't going to care. So, But yeah, so all of that was there. And learning about all this, like seeing all these patterns in a very deep and clear way. Yeah, but it was really interesting. I would say the middle month was probably the most interesting, because it's like you've been 4 weeks in. So you've pretty much, you notice you, you stop thinking so frequently about your friends and about your family. The first couple of weeks you're thinking, how's everyone doing? You know, I wonder what's going on. But after 4 weeks of not hearing from anyone and not talking to anyone, you kind of don't need to think about that. And then you're still so far away from the end, still 8 weeks to go. So you don't have to think about your future life. So that middle month I felt was the most special, because it was like summer camp or something as a 10-year-old. Like, you just don't have to, you can really be with the meditation and each moment. And actually around that time was the October 7th attack, because this was fall of 23, and we didn't have any news of that, didn't know about that. So it's kind of ironic that all this stuff's happening in the world, and at the same time, we're over there in the deepest part of the retreat, because there's no need to think about the world. So that was also a really interesting contrast that I learned about after, but yeah.
So for most people who are listening to the podcast, who may not ever go on retreat, I think that description may not be that inviting to them to thought that process. And yet, again, what you've described, the things that came out of it, the insights, the ability to have things arise, and just over the course of that time, you see some patterns arising and then become more and more comfortable with, okay, that's a pattern, et cetera, et cetera. I want to take that, if we can, as the foundation for stuff that now you've been able to see sort of, again, in real life, that the times, whether it has to do with, you know, decision to sell the company, the decisions to do, you know, in the midst of building the company up, dealing with stresses, et cetera, things that sort of evidence the awareness of what's going on. And sometimes you could tell the meditation and the mindfulness is really playing a part, and sometimes it's like, oops, right? So bring us into kind of now real life and some examples as they come to you of like, this is how stuff that I learned played out, or this is how just real life just kept playing out.
I think one I can give, you know, so yeah, I can give both sort of examples. One thing that upon reflection, I think I did not have a great awareness around was like, just all the other aspects of life. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs do this, but when I was running the business, I got very obsessed with the business and constantly making progress and the 10 next things I needed to do and we needed to do as a company. And that detracted from, you know, working out. I still meditated most mornings, which was good, but like didn't work out enough. And I didn't, probably should have lived with people more. I was living alone at different times. And I think it's like, I'm already so in my head and so in my own world that really outside of working on the business, I think I should have been around as many people as I could have been, socializing, moving, getting into other modes of being and hanging out. But you know, when you're an entrepreneur, you tend to just get really obsessed. And talk about that chattering mind. I mean, like, yeah, like, really stimulated the chattering mind for 5 years in a row, in a big way. So that was something that I think was a difficulty. And part of it was also, I think I was so into meditation that I thought, and again, another very young male thought, like that sitting eyes closed by yourself is the only thing you need to do to have balance in your life and to understand yourself and to understand the world. So I, looking back, I've learned a lot about like also sharing your feelings, talking to people, also dancing, you know, also working out, cooking, enjoying your life. Like, there's so many parts of life, and, you know, it's, you might not have them all in balance, but you want to be like firing on a lot of cylinders and not just sitting an hour every morning. So I think I put too many eggs in, not in the basket of mindfulness, but in the basket of sitting with your eyes closed.
Yeah. It's that to me is like, that underscores, that's why we're here. So the practice itself is great, important, beneficial, but it's not exclusive.
Yeah. Right?
It's not an exclusive path to becoming more mindful, nor is it the only way that your mindfulness should arise, right? Because there's so many different elements of our lives where we're not sitting on a cushion, and we need it, and we benefit from, you mentioned, connections and movement and self-care. And so that's that interesting thing. You're taking care of yourself in the one respect of like, I'm sitting quietly, and you know, I think you mentioned before that you do mostly Vipassana, right?
Yeah.
So you're quiet and you're having insights, et cetera, et cetera. But how does this show up? How do we incorporate the other elements of our life that are needed to balance?
Yeah, totally. So I think I learned a lot from that. And that's something, you know, having the ability to do so many retreats. And also I lived at a couple meditation centers for about a year and a half after the business. I got like all this perspective on those previous 5 years that was very helpful. And, you know, now I've been back in the world for 7 months and I'm trying to integrate all of it and live life a little more holistically. But it's definitely, I think, a very multifaceted thing. And I think my understanding also, yeah, of the practice has shifted to, I've shifted to be much more focused on the heart. And just like, even with teachers now, I really connect with people who are really where I can feel their soul coming through. And then there's other teachers who are a little more cerebral and who I used to really like, but now I feel like they're not, kind of like, I wonder if they're embracing like all of their aliveness. So yeah. And I think that shifted too, to where I really am connecting with like artists and musicians a lot more than I used to. And not that they're always practicing mindfulness, but I think often they do embody this sort of attention to themselves, connection to others. And they're on this wavelength naturally sometimes. So yeah. I mean, I'm trying also to think of, okay. So one example of like a time where mindfulness was applied, I think, was like in deciding to leave the business. I felt like I did do a good job of listening to my own heart, my own soul in that. And I had thought for a while that I knew my passion for meditation and psychology was a lot stronger than my passion for like snacks. But I was in Florida with my family for Thanksgiving, and a George Harrison song came on the radio, What Is Life? And I was like, this song is so good. And then I started looking into George Harrison more. I'd known he was a Beatle, but I didn't know about his like spiritual side, and kind of got obsessed with George. And then his dying words apparently were, everything in life can wait, but the search for God cannot wait. And then he said, and love one another. And he tacked that. Yeah. But, that really hit me, and I was like, okay, you know what? Maybe I do need to get serious about the search for God, because there are all these questions I have, and there's this interest to go deeper in meditation, and I don't know that this business is fulfilling me. So that was very helpful, and a couple other experiences got me to this place where I decided to sell the business or hire someone to replace me, but to get on the path to leaving.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I'm feeling George Harrison, and you know, his message post Beatles especially so strong, and I think there's a real beauty in sort of an honest search for God, however that may, you know, whatever way that may lead you. But having that sense of don't know mind, right? I don't know what the answer is to this, because there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of potential places that we can look for the spiritual, and keeping that open mind to say, well, what works for me, I think is very healthy, very healthy. And so I'm thinking about times when you found yourself on the hamster wheel, right? And that is, I think that's a really strong analogy for a lot of emerging young business leaders, but especially entrepreneurs. You've got so much at stake. And if you were to give some advice to a young entrepreneur about how to be able to balance or put in harmony that desire to develop and expand a business and to have one success tied to that, but at the same time be more open to the other aspects of life that can serve you while your energies are going so strongly in that direction. Do you have thoughts about that? Is it possible?
Well, I think something that was helpful for me, although I think it took me a really long time to accept, and probably would for many entrepreneurs, is like kind of the Buddha's framework around greed and aversion, right? It's like greed and aversion and ignorance are the causes of suffering. And so, you know, I think for many entrepreneurs like me, you can kind of be biased towards being a greed type, where like a lot of your pattern in life is to be convinced that the next shiny thing, achievement, romantic partner, experience is going to be like it, you know. And just if you, it's hard to fully embrace this truth, and we often forget it, but it's like the Buddha's saying, he's like, you know, this is a myth, basically, that you're going to get something and it's going to last as a source of happiness. And so I think that that's one thing of like, even if you sell your business for however much you want to sell it for, or way more in 5 years or whatever, it's like, it's not going to fundamentally solve your human equation. And so I think that's one thing. You know, there's an entrepreneur that wrote a book called Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, just as an encouragement for people to like, love the process of the problem and working on it, but not necessarily be obsessed with solving it entirely, just so you could stay invested in the process. I think that's probably one piece of advice. And so then, yeah, that means, oh, this is my life. This isn't just a 5-year sprint that's kind of separate from my life. This isn't the Manhattan Project where I'm going to go move to New Mexico for a few years and then I'll go back to living normally. Like, I think much better if you can to be like, treat it like you're a school teacher or something. This is my job. This is my vocation. So I can also do all the other things I love at the same time. But it's hard.
That being focused on the process rather than the results is kind of a huge aspect of being in the moment, isn't it? Right? And if you are, if you're content to be on that path and not obsessed with where the path is eventually taking you, right, and getting to that end point, there's typically a greater sense of contentment and willingness to let things be that need to be, and to be able to see, I think, with some more clarity, right? Because you're not missing the inputs that the process is telling you. Like, I think that's a fair assessment of what you're saying is like, if you're in love with the problem, you're going to spend more and more time kind of trying to uncover aspects of the problem versus I need to get here. I need to solve this and move on to accomplish that. Accomplishment is not a bad thing at all, but being obsessed with the accomplishment may be, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And it can really give you this sort of tunnel vision when you are obsessed with that end goal where, yeah, a lot of what's here, you either ignore, or it's not interesting to you if you can't see how it would contribute to the ultimate achievement. And that just narrows down your life a little bit. And I definitely experienced that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm thinking along those lines, the obsession with the accomplishment and the achievement can also sometimes influence us in negative ways, which is cutting corners. Again, not being honest and not being fair, right? Because it's we need to get here. And there are impediments, and sometimes there are people, sometimes there are rules, sometimes there's morals. And if we're obsessed with getting there, but not with how do we get there? And it sounds to me like that's stuff that maybe I'm reading between the lines, but I think I'm reading correctly. That seems to be coming out of you.
Yeah, I think that's exactly like still very difficult for me to integrate, but I'm getting slowly a little better at this over time of like the how, the actual quality of the experience and of the work as it's being done. Like is kind of, from the Buddhist perspective, it's kind of the most important piece, right? I had a teacher that told me, it's not even that the means don't justify the ends. It's that the means are the ends, you know, and that's the present moment, right? It's like the present moment is actually all you have.
So. I love that the means are. So who taught you that?
That was Gil Fronsdale.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember you mentioning something that Nico Hassett had said to you before the 3-month retreat.
Yeah.
You were obsessed with it being like the best 3 months and the most productive 3 months. What did he say to you?
Yeah, I was looking forward to this 3-month retreat so much, and I'd been on a 10-day retreat a few months prior that had been really mediocre. And so I said to Nico, like, I'm really worried the 3-month retreat is going to be 9 times that, and it's not going to be that interesting. And I'm like kind of banking on this being like one of the most fascinating experiences of my life. And Nico said, let's pray that that happens, that it's mediocre. And I was like, let's pray that it's like totally, you know, not satisfying and not interesting. And he was like, yeah, because it'll just help you reduce this attachment to the outcome. And allow you, you know, meditation is all about being with it, however it is, even if it is boring. So that took a lot of weight off my shoulders when he said that.
Hmm. So are you still studying with Nico?
Yeah, I am. I still talk to him every like month or two.
Yeah. I think you and I talked about the fact that we have a connection there as well, because Nico's wife, Devin, was my mentor going through my mindfulness meditation certification program. So interesting how the world kind of conspired these two people with great talent and great wisdom, and gentle, gracious souls with good senses of humor too.
Yeah. And the story of how they met is actually really interesting too, which I don't know if you've heard it, but it's very interesting. Yeah. I was on retreat with them in the fall of 24, and they told the story to us, and basically Nico was, I think, still a Zen monk in Colorado. And Devin had gone to a fortune teller, psychic, like recently before they'd met, where I think the person had said like, you're about to meet, you know, your life partner. And Nico, I think, went on some like Buddhist dating website or something that was out there. I've never heard of this, but you know, got matched for a date with a woman who was a Buddhist, and not Devin, but the woman brought Devin as just a friend. I think like she was traveling an hour or two to go meet Nico at his Zen monastery. And so she was like, oh, I'll bring someone else, just like a little uncomfortable. And Nico and Devin, basically right away, they could tell they had a real connection, but Nico and the person he was supposed to be on a date with, like, didn't really have a connection. So Nico talked to Devin for like 4 or 5 hours, something crazy. And they just really, it kind of took off from there. But it was funny because he was supposed to be on a date with someone else.
Yep. As another former Beatle said, John Lennon said, life happens when you're busy making plans.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things that I think you and I have both benefited from, I think you amazingly, is the work with teachers. And I think that again, trying to keep this in real time. Okay. So if we're thinking about folks who are inspired by, wow, I can see this man, Nick, has had a really interesting life and made some, you know, some great, very interesting, different choices that have turned out pretty well. And this meditation thing seems to have made a big difference. Okay, so not everybody we know is going to go on retreat, whether it's for a weekend, 4 days, 10 days, a month, or 3 months, or spend a year and a half living at different monasteries, right? On the other hand, there are aspects of what you were doing in sports and in college and with this business that would lead you to be able to, I would think, to be able to say, yeah, some of this I can see mindfulness having played a part, even if I hadn't done this. And things that would have, you know, things that I have benefited from just trying to find ways to stay in the moment or to get back into the moment. I think, you know, those are lessons that kind of parallel. For some, it's a Buddhist path. For others, it's like, I'm just paying attention when I'm walking outside. So do you do a little bit of both now?
Yeah, I think I am actually trying to get back sometimes to a simpler practice throughout the day. Like for a long time, I tried like the mental noting throughout the day of like, oh, like, you know, reaching, lifting, drinking, like, and the mental noting can be helpful, but I think sometimes it can feel a little tight for me if I have too much technique. So sometimes I do try to get back to a very basic sense of, okay, I've realized I'm here in a moment. Yeah. What does it feel like? What am I hearing? What am I seeing? And trying to flow with it and have it be a little more of a dance, and still within 5-10 seconds, usually I'll get caught up again in some thought pattern. But, yeah, I think I feel like the practice in the morning helps to like increase the amount of times throughout the day that I'm going to check in. And then when I do check in, I'm hoping to now be like as light as possible, but just kind of stay in the experience before I run off again into some fantasy or whatever. So, yeah. And then I think also like one of the things I've picked up on is just like, you know, a little more allowing, and especially with emotions. Like if I notice that there is an emotion present, or maybe I tune in and all of a sudden there's an emotion present because I was ignoring it, like trying to, or not even trying, like seeing if I can allow it a little bit more, even it's, you know, and often it's uncomfortable, but kind of knowing that being with those emotions is the path back to the present a lot of the times, versus like, if you continue to set them aside, then you're probably going to stay a little more distant because you're avoiding something that's here.
Yeah, that's not an easy trick, right? So being with the emotions, which is uncomfortable often. I mean, if it's a really nice emotion, you want to be with it and then you don't want to let it go.
Yep.
but those difficult emotions where you're feeling uncomfortable, maybe some pain, some fear, some anger, the ability to kind of let that marinate and learn from it, that ain't easy, but boy, there are lessons there, aren't there?
Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of lessons there, you know, and sometimes it might lead to a communication. Like you need to say something to someone. Like you need to change up something you're doing. Like there's usually, I don't know, I don't want to say usually, but often there is an action too. And so I think I've become really interested in that. And Joseph talks a lot about that. He's like, the more you tune in and the more you're aware of what's happening, the more you make wise choices. And so I think that awareness, action, cycle can be virtuous or can be vicious if you're not aware and then you make dumb choices or you do the same thing that never works. So, yeah, I think that's something I'm trying to continue to develop is like, okay, I feel something. It might mean I tell this person, this girl in front of me that I like her, even though usually I kind of wait another 3 months to say that because I'm scared, you know, like, or it might mean I tell someone something uncomfortable if something they said made me uncomfortable, but I usually don't say it because I avoid conflict. So like, there are definitely a lot of, sometimes that piece can be the hard part. I was aware and I got a signal, but now I actually have to, you know, Oren talks a lot about this, I think, of actually saying what you feel, what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just your reference to Oren J. Sofer, where again, at the end of the 4 day retreat, where we were sitting not far apart, but 4 days of silence, right? And that whole sense of his work around say what you mean and sort of noticing what needs to be said, and then just making sure that as you say it, you understand how it's landing and what's your intention, right? And we forget that all the time, don't we? It's like, you know, someone pisses you off and, you know, you tell them to go screw. It's like, well, was that helpful? You might take a moment to say, I'm angry. What's making me angry? And it may not have anything to do with that person.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And yeah, it's like, I think also a lot of this stuff is like, it doesn't always lead to the most immediately, like, I don't know. Yeah, a lot of this is counter to your impulse. So I'm just thinking also of cases where you would say something that's true, but it like causes a little bit of tension, but it's like, it's more real and it's more to the point. Right. So like, I think that's the same thing with feeling uncomfortable emotions. It's like, you're like front loading a bit more pain, but to spare yourself another week or another month of running around it and avoiding it. So it's like, that's been an interesting change for me too. I think I used to think this was all about just feeling calm and feeling good.
Right. I think that's one of the great myths, right? You know, the time we spend in meditation is ultimately, yeah, you may be calm while you're sitting and you may be a little calmer during the course of the day, but the purpose behind it is really not necessarily to be blissful, but rather to be present and be able to deal with what life is throwing at you with more clarity. And as you were saying before, making better decisions, taking into account more things, getting more data before you know, pausing before we react and having that response be something that ties into what we really would like to have happen, right? That we've thought through, this is an outcome. This is a direction that we'd like to be moving in a conversation with someone or in a business decision. This is what I'd like to see. Let me think through the ways where this can happen, but not have a knee jerk and act out of fear or anger. Feel it, notice the influence it's having over us, and taking a breath. And I think a lot of what you said around that, I just feel could be part of an entrepreneur's playbook, right? To say, you know, you've got to have energy, right? You've got to have passion. You've got to be motivated and you have to believe in yourself, but can you do that with some other elements?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be nice for entrepreneurs to weave it in. And, you know, I think also a lot of times the motivation has to be there to be able to like, okay, I'll still be obsessed with my goal, but I'll have like two or three other goals of being in touch with myself or like connecting with my employees more. Like, and I talked to someone on a plane recently who had a bunch of different ventures, and he seemed like he was very focused on a lot of different things, but really pushing all his projects forward. And he said, so you've done all this meditation, what would you say is the key to inner peace? And I said, my question to him was, do you want inner peace? Cause it sounds like you want your businesses to succeed and that's your main focus. So the first question would be, do you want it? I'm like, cause you have to want a certain quality of life, or you have to want, to care about your experience in the moment somewhat. So I think that's often the first piece is the motivation there. So hopefully, you know, if it is for someone, then I think they can start to learn these other aspects of the playbook. But if you remain super fixated, one track minded, on selling your business, let's say, then you're probably not going to weave in much else, because that's all you care about.
Right. Yeah. That sense of being fixated on that one goal takes away the openness to the other things that you can learn along the way, the other input, and the other, I think, some of the other joys, right? So it's harder in some respects, I think, to see that kind of business trajectory where you're open, you're learning from your mistakes, you're learning from the obstacles and the way the challenges, you're learning about yourself along the way and still being motivated towards a goal that is helping everybody make money, right? But I think it can happen. And I think there are examples where this has happened with a great deal of success. I think we, as a culture, get fixated on those monumental successes where someone's become the richest man in the world. And then we wonder, is there happiness there? You know, is there contentment there? And, you know, I'm thinking about one person. Actually, I'm thinking about a number of people. and interestingly,
yes.
As we think of, let's think of, you know, we think of billionaires. There are examples of billionaires who seem to be so obsessed and never happy and lashing out and making life miserable on everyone. And there are some examples where I've made it and I'm giving it away.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And it's like, I think that's one thing I've appreciated that Mark Cuban has said, I've seen him say before, is like, you can be kind in business. Like, no one said you have to be a shark, like the show. Like, you know, you can do both. You can be like terrible to people, you can be good to people, and you can succeed in both ways. And I think there's definitely, it's like, okay, so might as well just be good to people to the extent you're able to remember that and commit yourself to that, because it's more enjoyable, it's better for the world, and you can succeed, you know, I think to the same level or even more. So it's because you're not fighting everyone all the time. So like, yeah, I think the potential is there. It's just, it's easy to get obsessed with money and achievement, and our culture can, you know, praise, I think, some of these behaviors that are not always the most balanced or harmonious. Hmm.
So where do you see, you know, you're back at school. How much longer do you have before you finish your degree?
I've got another like nine months, 10 months. I'm finishing in March of next year.
That's pretty exciting. And
yeah,
do we have options on the horizon? Are there things that you're weighing? Do you have decisions already made? What's in store for you then?
Yeah, I'm probably going to decide in the next, like by the end of this year. I'm thinking most likely to get a master's in social work and become a therapist, which I feel like is the standard spiritual job that everyone gets. So I'm not sure I would practice my whole career. I think I'll definitely get restless and want to do more things, but therapy just seems like a beautiful way to connect with people and help people and also embody, you know, it's like the more present you can be, the better you are at your job. I feel like it'd be a nice thing for the next 5-10 years. So that's my current thinking.
I love it. I think it's highly needed. I think that, you know, I'm not telling you that you should simply serve the young burnout executives and entrepreneurs, but they can use you.
yeah.
But I want to celebrate what a really interesting path you've been on, and your willingness to share the stuff that you've learned, your passion. At the end, you may not be writing books and opening, well, not yet, but and opening, you know, hundreds of meditation centers, but doing therapy, you're doing on a one-on-one basis what many people need, that help, that support. And I think that's gracious and doesn't surprise me, having gotten to know you some. I wish you so well with that. And I want to stay in touch. And thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Clayton. It was a really fun conversation, and love the emphasis on the podcast on, you know, the real tangible ways we can bring this practice into our lives or the moments where we don't. But I think it's a great place to focus, and great chatting with you.